Well, Ben, I'm glad to have Michael back, and Michael left us in the last show with a question. He'd been reading Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan, which came out 45 years ago, and he didn't think that money was a medium. Since McLuhan was writing about all these technologies as media or mediums, I found that very intriguing. He didn't see McLuhan's point that money was a medium. So we're going to get into what Michael means by that. But I'll open with this. I'm reading from a New York Times op-ed from September 21st, 1974, that McLuhan wrote. And it's in the period of stagflation, when there was stagnation after the oil crisis of 73 and 74, and OPEC started going, and after the October War of 1973. So he's starting to get into the 70s bland out, where economic problems started happening, and the term stagflation came up, which was coined by my friend Dr. Beter, just as a side note. So stagflation, it's people losing jobs, oil's prices are going up, and there's inflation, so it's going in two directions. So McLuhan jumps in with this article called A Media Approach to Inflation, and I'm going to read the first two paragraphs short, then jump to the very end. So he starts off. And Michael said he looked at this and disagreed with the first couple of sentences, so we'll probably hear that in here. He starts off, until now there have been many equilibrium theories of inflation. I'm going to propose a disequilibrium theory based on the discontinuous nature of the electric information of today. In the 18th century, Adam Smith got economics into orbit by linking the laws of the market to the automatism of the Newtonian universe. By this rhetorical device, the laws of economics were given a rigor and lucidity that they did not then or now possess. At least Adam Smith gave his theory some relevance to the then dominant science of astronomy. Today, however, in the electric age, when the word makes the market, that's all capitalized, inflation theory still lumbers along the wagon wheels of 19th century rhetoric. The Marxists say inflation can be cured with more production, while the Keynesians say it can be cured with more money applied at the right place and time. Whereas all current inflation theories tend toward Newtonian rationality and balance, there is a huge disequilibrium factor of irrationality that results from information movement in simultaneous and instantaneous patterns. Now note, he says disequilibrium factor of rationality. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve about 8 or 9 years ago, became famous by saying we've been witnessing irrational exuberance. So McLuhan called it 25 years before Greenberg. What was this? Alan Greenberg? I forget his name. I just said it, didn't I? Is it Greenberg? Greenspan. What did I just say?
Alan Greenspan.
Oh, Greenspan. Right, right. Okay, so there's a lot of interesting literary statements, goes into technical stuff about television, and then he says the role of the interval, which is his explanation of the futures trade, which is just starting to take off in the 70s. He says the same interval which prompted the holder of gold coins to hoard the good ones, the unalloyed, now prompts the holder of paper money to gamble and to invest in, quote, futures, unquote. For the present and future of money is a diminishing utility. The old impulse to hoard gold now opens a market in antiquities, on the one hand, while gambling becomes a way of unloading the new liabilities constituted and incurred by the inflated currency. When money itself becomes an irresistible form of arbitrary taxation, think of that, Ben. Think of that. Money itself becomes an irresistible form of arbitrary taxation.
It's so Yankee, Bob.
What?
It's so American.
Okay, carry on. Listen to this.
I mean, you know, you're still fighting the War of Independence. This is 18th century. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, let me just finish. When money itself becomes an irresistible form of arbitrary taxation. Remember, he's a Canadian putting on the Americans. He's putting them on.
Absolutely. You know, unjust taxation. That's why you formed the nation of the United States, wasn't it?
That's right. He says when that happens, a situation develops which feeds the gambling mania to anticipate events by trading in futures and promises at intervals. Again, it is the speed and replay of information movement which creates a new kind of pattern recognition, which in turn makes it possible to see innumerable software gaps or information gaps in the old hardware situation of goods and services. To fill in these gaps speculatively is one aspect of the passion for development. Think of urban development in quotes, an aspect which has become inseparable from the big con, capital B-I-G, capital C-O-N. So then you go to the very end of the article, and he says, Henry Kissinger seems to be the current triggerman in this planetary game among the intervals of first, second, third, and fourth worlds. The first world being the industrialized West, the second being Russian socialism, the third the non-industrialized lands, and the fourth the electric world that's gone around the previous three, becoming the primum mobile or primum mobile of inflation and all the rest. Perhaps there's no better way of indicating the discontinuous simultaneous pattern of the new situation in economic society than to point to the nature of the TV image, which is structured by innumerable pulsations which move toward the viewer through the monitor. The TV image is literally constituted by a mesh or mosaic of live intervals which provide an overwhelming inducement to involvement on the part of the TV audience. The entire world of electric information now presents pulsating intervals for the intervention and involvement of the world population. The Arabs had small chance for action in the old hardware world of specialist markets and production. The new software world of electric information offers them ample entry points and intervals. And he was so correct about that, by 1975, the Saudis bought out the CIA. And that's documented.
So,
anyway,
but can you explain to me why, give us a history lesson, why in 1974 could Marshall McLuhan end an article about inflation by talking about the Arabs in an article for the New York Times? I mean, to me it seems like such a gone off at a tangent. I've been reading this article about inflation, I want to explain everything, and suddenly I have something about the Arabs. Was there a war on in 1974 that the Arabs were particularly the menace or something? I mean, why the Arabs? I couldn't understand the entry of the Arabs right at the end.
Yes, remember in October 73, Egypt attacked Israel.
Yeah.
Isn't that what happened?
Yeah.
There was that war.
It wasn't
the Six-Day War. That's in June 67.
Right, okay.
This is the second major one. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, Israel kind of won. And as a result, OPEC went into backlash and started hoarding oil, and the prices started going up. And then eventually, that's when the recession, depression started. It was still, that was the end of Nixon, and Ford comes in. And to the point in 1975, New York City declares bankruptcy, and Gerald Ford, President Ford, tells him to go fly a kite. See, that's when the downturn started, because of the Arabs having a fulcrum of power after the war. And so, since the Arabs had all the cash flow, they then bought up the universities and the CIA and took over the United States. And if you go to the Saudis, it seems that there's a lot of information after 9/11 that the Congress reported that the Saudis seem to be the ones who nailed the Twin Towers.
Now, I'm sorry, okay? Bob. The problem with McLuhanism...
The anti-credential. If we ever mention you, any of us are going to be in total doubt over who we are, over the things that we're talking about, because of how conspiracy theory this kind of stuff is.
Yeah, I cover the whole waterfront. I do conspiracy theory as well as bottom-up media theory. I do all of it. It's not wise.
But the problem
if
you have.
If you want to have a successful life in the disappeared world, do not mention me.
But the... The problem
you know
I
what
have
I said, disappeared world.
Bob, the problem ahead. I have with what you're saying is it's a classic McLuhanite mistake, which is taking symptoms for causes. And so you're talking about 1973, the downturn in the whole post-war economic boom, the first creaks in it, the cracks in it, being produced by the Arabs, who are, you're talking about actually people in control of oil. So you're talking about a fairly tiny capitalist class who control oil production as causing the downturn, not understanding...
No, he's not saying it's causing. That was what I was...
Well, no, that's what you're saying.
No.
Yeah, but that's... Yeah, but in circulating conventional history as this dubious area of we can never tell, and this is the way you explain McLuhan as well. Whenever you say, well, I disagree with this in McLuhan, you go, no, it's satire, it's upside down. You don't understand that he's summarizing everything he disagrees with. But this gives you the space to actually flounder around contradicting yourself without actually understanding anything at all. And so I have to object, particularly towards your characterization of the downturn that happened in the early 70s. Now, 1973 has been picked on by a lot of people as a special moment. Frederick Jameson argues that it's the watershed between modernism and postmodernism, the coup in Chile, big changes in the world, and the whole oil crisis is part of that. But the way a Marxist would understand what's happening is there is a general tendency of the profit rate to fall in capitalism, in structured capitalism, and it produces crises. This general tendency is there all the time, and because of the way in which capitalism works and the way people compete with each other, that by shedding labour they manage to get a few points ahead of the other firms. But if everybody does that, the general profit rate falls, because the only way you get profit is by exploiting labour. So if you shed all your labour, in fact, in the end, for everybody, there's less profits there. Now, that is the general tendency going on. That's the real cause of the downturn. These little symptoms of squabbles among different ruling classes about the slice of the pie may trigger wars, may trigger various crises and events, but they're not the real explanation of anything. So that's why Michael's saying it's conspiracy theory when you declare, oh, it was the Arabs who started it all. This is finger-pointing by the ruling classes, and it's not the kind of thing which a mass person such as ourselves, using a mass medium like the radio and trying to talk in ways in which anyone turning on the radio can understand from their own point of view and their own lives, should be thinking. All this conspiracy theory is stuff for the ruling classes. Stuff them. I'm not interested in their games and their accusations. We should be starting a revolution. We should be arguing something completely different.
You missed the point. McLuhan is not saying a conspiracy theory. He's saying it's a remarkably new democratic environment with the computer technology, and even the Arabs have a chance to enter. He's not blaming them at all. See, you didn't read this article carefully enough.
I don't.
The article quite
okay, Michael, you respond. Ben's response. Ben's response is ridiculous. Is it not nothing about? He just brought up conspiracy. I said, "Yeah, I cover conspiracy." McLuhan's not blaming it on the Arabs.
I didn't say he was blaming it on the Arabs. I was saying people do, and the interest.
Well, we didn't. We're not talking about that. There's no conspiracy theory here.
But why does it matter what the Arabs are doing? Why do they come in at the end?
No, because he's citing what it does become important.
But Bob,
do become important.
Bob, I asked you.
This is why they get in.
Bob, I asked you why the Arabs are there, and you went into an explanation of the downturn, which is about the Arabs buying up the CIA or whatever. You know, so you went into pointing the finger at the Arabs, and I'm defending the Arabic peoples versus these slurs which are produced by ruling classes having arguments with each other, which I'm saying that mass people should not enter into these arguments.
I'm saying the Arabs saved the CIA.
I'm the equivalent to Bob, you don't understand. Bob, I'm saying that I'm the equivalent of somebody before the First World War saying that I'm not going to listen to people saying it was the Germans or the French or the English. I'm saying this war is stupid, okay? I'm saying that I'm not going to fight the war, that I believe in class war. I don't believe in these wars of blocks of people. Whereas you are falling into that. By explaining the whole 70s downturn as a result of what the Arabs did, you are falling into explanations which go into war. Well, you are. You are recycling the same stupid ideas.
The discontinuous nature of the electric information up to date. He's offering a solution to the issue. And it became true what he said. Now, you haven't been tracking what economists said for the last 25 years in the business, and you don't know that he is right on. Anybody who hears this is amazed that McLuhan was onto it. Now, I want to find out what you're missing.
Well, the same tripe is being circulated by a few people. Doesn't amaze me at all. Why is it amazing that the same mistakes and the same confusions circulated over decades should, you know, be repeated? This is not amazing at all. Nonsense is repeated by nonsensical people. Why is that amazing, Bob?
It's amazing that people take the content of McLuhan's article and come up with a meme that they professionally can ride with for 25 years and don't even know what he is saying or critiquing on a deeper level.
But why doesn't he make this criticism explicit?
Marshall McLuhan ever had an idea of futures trades, ever had the idea of increasing the speed of trading in order to... And completely ignoring labor as the determining factor of wealth.
He talks about labor in other articles, but this one is about the electric and electronic environment. And what's original is he links the patterns in different fields from chaos theory into economic theory and its collapse,
Bob,
to a cause.
Bob, the
That's
cause.
What's original.
Marshall McLuhan, in this article, is saying the world has got crazy with gambling and it's dangerous. This article could have been written in 1720 by a parson from a Christian background disapproving of the people who put their money into the South Sea bubble. It's as simple as that. It's not amazing and predictive. It's an old hat moralistic criticism of gambling and capitalism. That's all it is.
No, that's what he always says in his articles that he's not doing.
Mm. Well, he's denying
he's
the truth.
Doing that.
Unfortunately, that's what he is doing. There's no other idea in it except the idea that gambling's bad and you'll hurt yourself. It's Russian roulette. It's dangerous.
He says gambling is good. He says gambling is good.
Well, gambling's good.
And creates wealth.
He doesn't say that in this article.
If you don't know what's happening, then you think you're in a recession or depression. Like, why was
Labor
there the recovery
in...
But it's not true. Gambling creates money for private individuals. Well, that's not wealth. Wealth is real goods. Something real. For everybody.
Labor creates it.
Yeah, labor creates it.
With
I haven't seen any laborers. What are the laborers doing?
They're well, you wouldn't. You're a millionaire on a beach in Hawaii. Labor. Where would you see the laborers? They're the people bringing your drink, Bob. Have you seen them? Do you ever see them?
No, I don't.
No.
But you know what they're doing? They are doing that as a side. They got three jobs, and two of them are involved with typing or providing software content. They're probably in a band. And that's
well,
before.
So,
now
is that not labor? Is this typing not labor?
Yeah, I mean, it's labor, but it ain't. What labor is it? It's typing.
Well, all human activity can be viewed as labor. I mean, it's all activity. The problem is we're locked in a system where you need to get money for it. Therefore, you're only allowed to have activity if it's going to be exploitable for making profit for somewhere else. That's how it works. And that's what me and Michael disagree with. And you say you're on our side in this revolution, but with the ideas that you're throwing around at the minute, they're the fantasies of people who are speculating with money. That's how you're thinking. You're locked into a capitalist view of the world, so you can't understand what we're saying to you.
No, I'm always explaining the absurdity of that. The absurdity
but it doesn't
of that so,
why
situation.
Doesn't it sound absurd to us? Why doesn't it sound like McLuhan and you are explaining how absurd it is? Because when I read it, it sounds excited by it. It sounds boosterish. It sounds like, don't you realize that TV is uniting everybody on the planet? Whereas I see everybody separated in their rooms watching TV and
that's
not being united.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
so
what the digital body did. You have to pay a bit of attention to what I've been saying, but you don't go back and listen to them. The digital body fragmented everybody. The unifying effect of television, and it was a surface unity, was in the 50s and 60s. That's long gone, 40 years ago. But let's go. Why don't we go to why Michael says that money is not a medium? Let's begin with that simple premise. Why isn't it a medium?
Well, the thing is that the word medium has such a heavy resonance within the McLuhanite universe that here we should have a debate about how you define terms. This
I
is
agree.
Why because
let's
you use it like
Michael's definition.
Michael's definition of medium is a
no money of money. Okay, and what
money.
Is your definition of money?
Money, I would define as an anti-medium. It's something that makes people into media. Which I think is perverse and kind of Nazi-ish.
That's exactly correct. Your words are, they're loaded. And so what do you propose we say in light of that effect? McLuhan would exactly
agree
with you.
I say let's get rid of the ruling class and let's unite all workers of the world.
Okay, so how do we start? Let's start today, right now. Where do we go? We can't go to George Galloway. He screwed up and went on TV.
It wasn't going on TV that screwed up.
No, it's not because he went on TV that he screwed up. It's because he was uniting with the middle class shop owners rather than the workers.
So how do we get to them? I'm willing to help you lead this charge. Where are they?
Bob, I don't need a they. I am one of them. You see, I don't accept you're putting the working class out, you know, beyond where we are. I'm not a capitalist.
So we're going to organize Ben.
Yeah.
We're going to work with Ben.
Exactly. Okay. I want you to organize my life. I mean, here's my life as a child carer. That's how I earn my living. If I don't take care of the children, my whole life falls to bits. And I used to look at the feminist argument about wages for house workers completely ridiculous. Now I can see what it means. And I think that I'm one of the oppressed of the earth, that I'm taking care of the next fodder for capitalist exploitation, and I get very little help. There's very little resources given to parents. They're completely knackered out by taking care of their children, and I think I'm one of the proletarians of the world. I don't see myself as, because I can talk a lot and because I'm on the radio, as somehow part of this, you know, kind of super layer of exploiters. I see myself as part of the struggle of ordinary exploited people to get a little bit more fun in their lives and to see things. So I see myself, I don't see, you immediately have a they, you know, great battalions of workers out there. To me, and this may be a problem of being a millionaire, is that you can't have any sympathy with people just who face the fact that either you work or you starve or you try and get a benefit. That's what faces you in this world. And we all go out and try and make a living. And those are the people I sympathise with and I want to talk to and organise. And you make attempts to organise them, however small or however large they can be. And okay, proposing that as, you know, completely preposterous and kind of where are they and it's impossible is kind of the thing that media stars say. But these are people who think they're under some kind of spotlight and that they're not an ordinary person. And I'm surprised at you, Bob, because you, via McLuhan, you talk about James Joyce. And for me, James Joyce is the expression of this common or garden point of view. I think that's what James Joyce was trying to write from.
Well, certainly, I've always worked with the working class. I work in working class media, you know, non-commercial networks. Okay, so how can I help?
I don't understand that, because I understand.
How can I help, Ben?
I understand the working class is completely bound up with the commercial. I mean, we are products of a commercial system.
No, but we give them free. We give them free content. That's what we did at CKLN. We didn't charge them.
You gave them. Well, they don't want it. That's why you can't charge them for it. They're too clever.
All right. Well, okay. I gave it to me. What with them? I gave it to us. I gave us free information.
Yeah.
So how do I help you, Ben?
You don't need to help me. You help me by entertaining me and by.
Don't relegate me to entertainment. I'm leading a revolution.
Yeah, and allowing me to
engage my revolution.
No, because I find you stimulating, Bob, most of the time. Not in this program, but usually. And
you will be stimulated before this is over.
Well, this is what I'm ardently desiring, and that the idea of talking to you is that you challenge my complacency about a certain point of view and area of activities which are necessary, and use Frank Zappa as a common understanding we both have as a mode of practice and operation and a special dealing between subjectivity and objectivity about our desires and what the world's like, and that we use that in order to talk about social theory, about Karl Marx, Marshall McLuhan, any other theorists who try to explain what this society is to us. And I thought that's what we were up to, and that's why I like talking to you.
Okay, but then if that's what we're up to, let's continue talking theory. But you're talking about you know, you need a better situation for your housekeeping, and I'm wondering how I can help. How can Michael help you? Michael's up against all these students who are post-structuralists. He just was complaining a little while ago about it. I mean, where we begin other than with you, Ben?
Well, we're already well past beginnings. This is the 17th hour of discussion, so we don't need to worry about how to begin because we have begun. And in fact, nobody ever needs to worry about how to begin because they already have begun, because they're there. So beginnings are not really a problem. That's a religious concept.
In terms of working class revolution, where do you begin? It's already been begun, and you look around you. I mean, there's unions, there's universities, presumably, or places where ideas can come into conflict, and you can still have some sort of a
free
say
discussion,
and still have some sort of a way into these students' minds. You go to any place and anywhere in this modern world, and that's the working class. Everything around you is made by people. So as in like alchemy, where you look around the world and you have this paranoid feeling that you can read the world. In today's world, you really can, because everything is man-made.
Right, so that's happening. You guys object to the explanations that the major media give of the situation.
Well, it's the non-attempt to explain it. The idea of explaining it would be an interruption. The idea of explaining anything wouldn't be what the major media are about. The major media are about massaging your particular sense of identity or your particular self, or it's flattering you. And therefore, the idea of explaining anything would immediately imply that there are things you don't understand or things we don't understand, you know, or the people who are talking. And therefore, that goes against, you know, the whole grain of how modern mass media work. And so if you want to interrupt that, you have to operate in a different way completely.
Yeah, which is presumably what we're all doing here.
Yeah, and this is why we have common ground in Frank Zappa, who seemed to do that to the rock music of the 60s and 70s.
So, Michael, why is money... Money does communicate, but it doesn't communicate the way you would like it to communicate.
I think it stifles communication. It makes us all just ciphers for codes that are created, like in the post-structuralist nightmare, that everybody's just stuck within the expression of stuff that we were born into, and that we really have no basic subjectivity, and if we did, it wouldn't matter because it doesn't make us money. I think that, yeah, money is the opposite of actual meaningful expression.
Meaningful expression. See, there's the subjectivity.
Subjectively meaningful. The meaningful, not in terms of the ruling class or in terms of, you know, buying up things. Meaningful in terms of, well, presumably what we're trying to do here on this show.
You have to introduce the idea of the private versus the public, or the individual versus the social, because money is a private claim upon a social good. That's what it is. And that's why to support it and fantasize about it is always a kind of, for me, a rather embarrassing thing to hear somebody say, oh, I wish I had loads of money, because everybody wishes they had loads of money, and that's why we have a competitive, horrible system. And you're not trying to imagine anything better than the situation that actually exists, which is a competitive system of everybody wishing they had money. And the point is that this system of competition has created the means to have something completely different, and this is what occurs in the great revolutions, probably in my lifetime. 1968 throughout the world produced the most extreme anti-capitalist moment of realization that people don't need to live like that, that we have the basis set up by capitalism, and I'm very grateful for it, for technologies and productions, for us to actually live in a way in which we're not distrusting everybody and thinking we can only get ahead by elbowing everybody else in the face. And it's that socialist idea which to me is the revolutionary idea that I wanted to develop.
Okay, let's start developing it. Everybody's been developing it. It's well developed.
It's well developed, but it's full of problems. It's been full of setbacks and travesties and treachery.
Okay, what caused those problems and setbacks?
Defeat.
Why were they defeated?
After 1968, when it didn't actually turn into a revolution, you get a lot of idiotic theorists such as Derrida and Foucault and all that.
It did exist before 1968. They existed before 1968, but they weren't big or attractive because they were considered irrelevant reactionaries working in their closets. But after 1968 and the big disappointment about what happened, people clung on to those and went back to them, and they became very popular.
Yeah, and for the last, 40 years, universities seem to be spewing out the same old crap about, everything is... All the systems of authority are inevitable and immovable, and we're born into it, and that's all there is to it.
Which is why it's interesting.
Conservative, and
which is why it is stimulating and interesting for Bob to throw McLuhan into that.
Yeah.
because McLuhan is not part of that reaction. McLuhan is a kinky, individualistic thinker trying to relate things which are normally not related. I mean, from the article that you read out from just now, Bob, and which you circulated to us before the program, the bit that interested me was the nature of the TV image, which you read out, actually, which is structured by innumerable pulsations which move toward the viewer through the monitor. And I think what McLuhan is putting his finger on is the centrality of the person watching the TV rather than the TV system. So he's putting back what Michael wants, that structuralism ignores, which is our response and our subjectivity. Not meaning that he wants to swim back to romantic subjectivity, which doesn't recognise society and doesn't care about anything. You know, he's analysing television and economics and all the rest of it. But he's producing this analysis which is trying to articulate what the person subjected to media is going through. And that, for me, is dialectical. That, for me, is revolutionary. That really matters. And so that's where I link into McLuhan, and I can understand your McLuhanism, because it has that moment. Whereas so much says, well, no, what really matters is mass, the market here, and all these people listen to that, and they all like that. So who are you, one person, to disagree? You know, you're just one person. You're nothing compared to the masses of people. McLuhan's not doing that, and that is crucial. And without that, you don't have any dialectics or revolution.
Yeah, very good. Good, Ben. Yeah, I would say just the first...
Isn't it great being in a seminar with Bob Dean, the Dean of Social Theory?
Bob Dean. There's no Bob Dean. Bob Dobbs.
Well, I was just thinking about deans, you know, and yes, the American use of that to mean the...
The Dean of McLuhanism.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's great to have a seminar with me.
Mm.
I listen. Carry on, Ben and Michael. I'm there, the Don, the wise Don, right, marking the statements as
okay.
I pass.
Yeah, but Bob, how important is it to recognize that dialectical link between objective analysis and the subjective experience in McLuhan? Have I got to the heart of McLuhanism yet?
Yes, Bob. And that dialectic is what you always stress in your books. You make little pairings of different situations, different them versus us kind of thing. That's exactly what he's doing. People called him a rhetorician or grammarian, but the Tribune was made up of dialectics, rhetoric, and grammar, and he actually was a closet dialectician.
Mm.
His books.
It is somewhat...
always I versus E.
Yeah, it is somewhat closeted. I'd like McLuhan's dialectic to step out of the shell of kind of quasi-scientific terminology, because in a way McLuhan reminds me of Pierre Bourdieu,
who was influenced by McLuhan greatly.
Yeah, they're rebellious intellectuals who realize that in the wider world, in academia or in the media, you've got to set up a front of a system of terms which can explain the world. So you set up a system of terms and you keep hammering on them, and they're your possession. And I can sort of see where these people are, and they're kind of signposts for you, us navigating our way through ideas. And so in that sense, I don't totally diss them. On the other hand, I'm for a kind of thinking which... only thinking about it now has made me realise that I think like this. Something a little bit more flexible and satirical and less armoured and less presenting a system, more kind of making a joke on everybody else's system and blowing things up. I feel like they're trying to form national armies and I want to be a guerrilla.
Yes, McLuhan says that very point.
Encore of Dynamo Hum.
What?
Yes, McLuhan says that very point, Ben, in his first explorations essay in 53-54. He talks about the seminar that he's publishing and how we have to have the term subject to self-redefinition ongoing and with a, he doesn't say sense of humor, but that's implied. It's interesting that what you just said is how I perceive what McLuhan did.
Mm. Well, the thing is that I am the expression of your McLuhanism, that I'm in fact an illusory meme that's being projected by you in Hawaii that you needed somebody who was into Zappa who could express this, and therefore I've come into being.
That's right. Well, that's loaded. I've created a lot, but yes, you have. It was so delightful to read your book back in the 90s. I said, wow, this guy is he's talking me. You know, this is, we didn't meet for many years, but That's why I called you the Ben Watson Collective. You were a meme.
But this is what we're trying to work out. If we could thrash it out properly, we'd have an actual philosophy that wouldn't get caught in jargons of sets of terms. Because I do find
okay,
it...
Okay, that's good.
You know, I do think...
Michael ask us about that, or state. How would Michael
where does
want
Michael,
to express?
Where do you stand on that, Michael?
Well, I think that, I stand on it in the same sort of way that my lovely fiance Danielle stands on it, which is that from her perspective, philosophy is just a lot of BS because of all of these slogans and all of this kind of, it's just sloganeering at this point. In order to be a philosopher, you have to be accepted into the academy, and you have to give credit to all the right kind of people, and you have to make people comfortable by basically becoming opaque.
As a footnote to what you're saying, Michael, there is a relationship to the non-academic within, say, French thinking, French radical thinking, that a lot of the people fed to us, you know, like Gilles Deleuze, they don't spend their time actually in academia, that they have a relationship to academia, but they're often anarchist or radical or political and spend their time outside, and there's a trade-off, you know. It's not quite, there's just simply the academy neutering everything, and that's what we get fed.
Well, also there's also
incorrectness outside the academy, which feeds into the academy, and because it doesn't know how to protect itself from academification.
There is also that whole tradition, the intellectual tradition within European culture, where a big name philosopher will get printed in a major newspaper.
Well, this is the power of this is the post-war
New York Times as well.
But this is the post-war situation of Jean-Paul Sartre, isn't it? I mean, everybody, all the post-structuralists are trying to step into Sartre's shoes, which is being the big confused body who doesn't really know politically whether he's for or against the Communist Party. He can't really decide, but he's a bit like Pete Townsend in the world of rock. You know, you got to read like articles and articles by this person who's vacillating and doesn't really know. And that big figure is those shoes they all want to occupy.
Dinosaur shoes.
They're dinosaur shoes, and they're rotten shoes, and it all, the French thing goes back to Sartre, which is a unique development, and probably that explains the power of French thinking, why is it exported so often to the Anglophone world, where it seems like nobody can think anything in America and England. We always have to import these Frenchmen, and it's to do with what Sartre created after the Second World War in Paris. This sort of...
there's a schmuck, actually, in my university, one of my classes, that was explaining one of his thesis, and someone came up with, oh, that reminds me of Heidegger, and he said, oh no, for me philosophy is French or nothing at all.
Yeah, but then all the worst things in French philosophy come from Heidegger. I mean, Sartre has spent his time reading Heidegger. Lacan comes from Heidegger. All the worst things about 20th century philosophy come from a Nazi, funnily enough.
Yeah.
And the French transmission belt, which I still find hard to understand, but it's something to do with we fought the war, and now we're going to show how beyond the war we are by not going on and being anti-German. But they pick on the worst German philosopher of all, you know. It's kind of like
colonialism, post-colonialism. It would be as though the African nations that were colonized said, okay, all of our philosophy will now be based upon, drum roll please, our colonizers.
You think, well, I don't quite get that, because, you know, Germany had been defeated.
The Nazis came in and took over Paris, and after they were gone, all of the French philosophers decided, okay, let's start from Nazi philosophy.
I mean, I've always thought it was because the history of the 20th century is a standoff between fascism and communism, and the liberal who stands in between has got to kind of have both. So they have a little bit of Heidegger, and then they read a bit of Marx, and then they try and kind of worm their way through.
Yeah, they want
the
balance.
Yeah. And that's because they're Stalinists, because they think that Marxism leads to horrors and you need to balance it with a bit of fascism. That if you balance, you know, bad Marxism with a bit of Nazism, we might get something in the middle that's okay. And they don't have an imminent critique of Stalinism, which has to be Marxist. In other words, the French never read Trotsky, and that's the problem with them. Although some did, and they're the better ones. What do you think, Bob, about this? I mean,
very
Bob, you're entertained, but it doesn't touch you at all. I mean, there you are in your McLuhanite castle looking at these the problems of the Europeans. But it's still a fact that this French problem, the post-Sartrean, the eminence of French philosophy and theory, has swept the United States and academia as well. Are you totally immune to that? Are you totally immune to that, or don't you care, or, you know, you don't notice it?
I spent the last 20 years, I've even been invited to speak in universities to critique the university. I critique the universities using McLuhan and some other things to point out that they got it all from McLuhan and you got it wrong, and you're doing it backwards. Yeah, I think it's sad that Michael has to go to university.
Mm.
I mean, it sounds terrible. I mean, why are you going?
Yeah, Michael, why are you there?
I need money. Well, what? You're not going to get it in university. Now, that's nuts. You're not going to get any money in university. You're just going to get in debt.
Well, how much do they give you for being at university?
Get out of university so you can get some money.
I can't. Like, I need my degree in order to get a job in editing.
No, degrees aren't recognized anymore. Nothing is happening on that level. Geez, I mean, Michael, you got to start catching up on what's happening. You're in trouble going to university. Get a job in editing? Come on. There's no jobs in editing. There's nothing happening.
Well, give me some money and we'll be all right. Hmm?
Okay, what would we do with it? If I gave you some money, what would you do with it?
Michael, are you sure you're being honest? Are you sure it's not just for the pussy that you're going to university?
In a sense, because I have to delay... I have to be here for a certain amount of time, and then I'm going to get married and into Danielle, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's a way of staying.
So in
there.
A sense, you know.
So you enter these institutions for social
you're
reasons.
You're going bourgeois, and you're going to get married. Come on, Ben. Where'd you get this guy? This is a bourgeois guy getting married. Why, Michael?
Bob,
why get
Bob.
Married?
It's the only way I can get into England.
Well, I found it impossible.
You have these crazy goals. I want to make money, but you go to the wrong place with money, and you want to go to England. Why do you want to get to England?
Oh, because I want to work with Ben.
Yeah, he wants to edit my archive. But, Bob.
This is ridiculous. Oh, sorry. This is great. I think we should help Ben. Yes, we need to get Ben's the revolution. I'm working with Ben.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're all going to come here and work for the revolution in a moment.
Yes.
I'm trying to work out, Bob, where you stand on young people and how you're so well informed about which jobs there are and, you know, who are you talking to? How do you know what one should do and what's the way through and how to make money? You know, what's your information?
My lifestyle is involved with all classes and ages and types, and I've got foster children to keep me up on what's happening, but they're getting old now. They're in their 40s. But I've always attracted young people, and I always hearing what's I get emails from all the time, and I attract middle age and old people. So I'm all over the place, Ben. I'm a switchboard.
Okay, good. But what's this way of making a living without getting a degree? You know, I'm interested in that. Driving a bus.
I think that you should go out and invent some new ways of making community, which will be money, will be meaningful money. I think you need to going to England.
Meaningful money.
Well, I meant meaningful exchange. I mean, you guys should not be waiting in university. Go out and create your own reality. Now, I know you're up against, and that's really impossible, seems impossible, but more and more you're going to be forced to do that over the next couple of years because there's not going to be anything going on. going to be martial law. You're going to have to invent your life, Michael. Invent and based. You're going to be a Trotskyite. You're going to have to invent new things. Contingency. What is the dialectic, Ben? Contingency and... What was the dialectic you said?
And the one.
Contingency and the one. I mean, you're dead, Michael. You know, all the kids are killed immediately, and they don't know how to respond to the present. So I'm out there trying to encourage them to do it.
Well,
to invent something.
Bob, give Michael a break. Bob, give Michael a break in the sense that it's quite productive to enter into education with a lot of anti-educational ideas, or at least against the current ruling set of ideas within education. I mean, if you're bright and you like reading and writing, it might be a good place to be, because other places where you might be, you occupy yourself so much with earning the money, and it's you haven't got time to read and think. So university is a place where you're at least allowed to read, although they tell you all the books that maybe you shouldn't ought to read and you don't like. But having a kind of an oppositional attitude going that path doesn't seem to me a complete silliness.
I sound oppositional. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying you're telling Michael should totally reinvent himself and go and have a commune or set up a business or just do something completely different. And I'm saying, well, I can understand that.
You can't do that individually.
Yeah, that when you're on your, you know.
That's what I mean. Find a collective. That's what I was saying. Find a community.
Well, we're all casting around to find collectives, aren't we?
Not a commune. I'm not telling you how to live in the collective, but there must be people. Now, I know you're going to get no response in this. Your life is going around being frustrated at what they're teaching you. The anti-educational theories are so boring and obsolete. You're in a prison, Michael.
But Michael,
you're in a prison. You're forced to go to university.
Saying they're boring and obsolete, Bob, implies that there's this wonderful progressive future which we're always heading towards, which is going to be better. And I think the ideas they're teaching are vicious and atrocious and toxic, but they're very active and very lively and depressingly may dominate the future for some time. There's a positivism in your arguments that you fall back on. Whenever I criticise you for them, you sort of agree with me. But there's a way of expressions you have about the only way to answer something is to get ahead and get the new thing, which seems to me very consumerist, very American, and quite shockingly reactionary. Because it seems to me that the revival of past times has always been the thing which has created the great moments in our civilization. In the Renaissance, they thought they were reinventing the classical age. And I don't mind saying now to reinvent a wonderful age, or rather to actually change things for the better, we mustn't be thinking about this disappearing possible future where this and that and the other. I want to revive the 1920s and 1930s and all the extraordinary ideas they had then. I'm certain that if I could do it with enough people, we'd invent something completely different. I don't want to reproduce it, actually. But I'm saying that humanity does not simply progress on a timeline, that it goes backwards and forwards, that it has regressions. I think the thought of politicians since Lenin has completely deteriorated into charlatans and opportunists who admit they are charlatans and opportunists. That the last time philosophy had any real connection to politics was with the Russian Revolution. I'm not nostalgic for it. It's not talking about going backwards. It's just saying that humanity does not simply on a timeline always go forward. That you get high watermarks and then you get the tide goes back. And you have to remember what those high watermarks are. And remembering those high watermarks of the past may be the revolution that you need for the future. Do you think that's true or am I mad?
No, it's exactly what McLuhan says. He has a technical term of tetrad. And again, Ben, you keep bringing us back to McLuhan. I do not say any of that stuff. That's what McLuhan says.
Look, I don't bring it back to McLuhan.
Anything or to go forward in the future. I said invent a new connection with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying what the new is.
Okay, well, for instance, does it count the fact that I put together, with a good deal of help, the New Zealand Surrealist group? Does that matter, or is that's not new enough?
No, that's good. What you mean? You get together and discuss things, or you produce products? What happens?
Yeah, all of those.
All is it on the internet? Is it on the internet?
Not yet.
Okay, so you're doing that.
Have you met that's anybody great. Good, Michael?
What's that?
Have you met anybody good? I mean, oh, Danielle's fantastic, yeah. But who else have you met? Have you met any? Are they all? You know, who are they?
There's a young woman by the name of Holly who is a vegan feminist anarchist, and I think she's great. And there's also Stefan. He's a German animator. I think he's pretty good too. Although he needs some political education, so maybe he should listen to 17 Hours of Us.
Yeah.
And
you can talk to these people. And do they leave your room if you play them Frank Zappa records?
I have yet to actually play them the Frank. Yeah. But I figured we're already hitting it off on a number of other levels, so Frank might not be necessary as the goad towards interesting material.
Good. Yeah.
And you meet these people in person?
Well, I did when I was in New Zealand. Now I'm in Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, that was...
And,
they're rather far away.
Not that far away. Yeah. Not as far away as you guys.
But what me and Bob have discovered is that the proximity of actual people doesn't really... I mean, this is the weird thing I'm still trying to understand, is exactly why do I feel... I look forward to this as my weekly party, you know? And yet I'm standing... You know, I'm sitting in front of Esther's computer. And I've always objected to... a lot of things which bring you back to the computer. Like, I don't like emails. You know, people send me emails and I don't answer them, and I don't want to be try and get on the Zappanali website and the passwords and everything, and I've spent 10 minutes at the computer and I give up and I just refuse to be in front of the computer. But there's something different about talking with Skype for me, because I'm not operating a keyboard.
Responding in real time.
I'm responding in real time. Everything is not via the alphabetical system and typing. So there's some kind of orality and instantaneity about it, which is improvised and critical and kind of makes me alert. And it's a very, very different form of attention that I'm giving this screen, and I'm not watching TV. I mean, the screen doesn't change. It's the same old nonsense that was up there before. But I don't mind that, because I'm thinking, and that the denial of what's immediately in front of me seems to be essential for thinking. And having a voice in my head's fine, but then it's not like the telephone. I don't like telephones. They're too personal and too gossipy. I think it may be because me and Bob have set this up to broadcast on the radio, so we're always thinking about a mass audience while we're doing it.
Yeah, we've made it media. Skype with radio. We've made it media.
Yeah.
That's what's exciting.
But use media in that way, Bob, what you mean is something prepared for public display.
Yes. Media. I'm just saying we made Skype, and then we record it, and we put it on the radio, a different
medium. Absolutely. Or we put it up in archive.org for people to download. But it's the awareness while we're talking. We're improvising and being spontaneous, but we're aware that there's a whole possible mass audience listening to us. And that's the elevated level of life I'd like to live on all the time, but the only person I know who's managed to do it is Gamma. Because Gamma...
He broadcasts?
All the time. Every statement he says is said in a way that you could record and would be fantastic. He performs all the time. He's always plugged in to a awareness of what it would sound like if it were on a record all through his everyday life.
Yeah,
having lived in New York for most of my life, I always have the sense that someone could be watching.
Well, it's not quite. I'm not quite talking about paranoia. I'm talking about a more benign thing, or a more performing thing, I suppose.
He's a product of the global theater. McLuhan predicted that sensibility would go through the whole world with the satellite. Everybody would become an actor.
Okay, Bob, you've got 30 seconds to wrap this up. We're near the end of the show.
The new software world of Electric Gamma offers Ben ample entry points and intervals, and I hope to repeat that.
Well, we shall, and it'll be number 18.
Yes.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Although, thank you.
We plug in the thing at the end of this that says all that, so we don't need to say it. A bit of silence.
Workers of the world unite.